This is Ozarks at Large. Claude Baydoun is an associate professor of law at the University of Arkansas. He's also senior affiliated faculty at the University of California, Berkeley Islamophobia Research and Documentation Project. He's an observer of how policy, law, government, and society can contribute to stereotypes and worse toward Muslims. His book, American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear, is now out in paperback. We invited him to the Anthony and Susan Hoy News Studio this week to discuss the book and to discuss the very definition of Islamophobia.
So in the spirit of addressing policy, I want to construct a more complex and nuanced definition for Islamophobia. One dimension of it is what I call private Islamophobia. It is the more explicit brand of animus or violence that's inflicted by bigots, hate mongers, individuals with a specific sort of political objective. The second primary dimension is what I call structural or state-sponsored Islamophobia, which tends to be more facially neutral. It's hard to assess whether it is on its face explicitly discriminatory toward Muslims. And this is in the form we can think about the travel ban, the Muslim ban, for instance, as a manifestation. We can think about the Patriot Act enacted after 9/11 as another manifestation. In many states in the South, we can think about this wave of anti-Sharia bans as being manifestations of structural or state-sponsored Islamophobia. And the third dimension is what I call dialectical Islamophobia, which is more of a process. It is the process by which the state's endorsement and enforcement of these laws effectively endorses private attitudes, private negative attitudes that individuals and citizens have of Muslims. So it's a dynamic where law is actually propagating and perpetuating the kind of negative ideas people have on the ground.
What's an example of that? Because that can be much more subtle than the visual hate mongering.
Yeah. So for instance, it could be – so in the South again, Arkansas actually passed an anti-Sharia bill in 2017, which effectively prohibits courts from citing Islamic law. Right. So what that effectively does is this is the state legislature saying that anything Islamic, anything related with the religion of Islam is threatening, is violent, cannot be assimilated with American values and American ideals. In addition to law, law is also a set of ideas that are disseminated more broadly to the people. So if the legislature is saying that Islam as a religion is categorically violent and villainous, that's communicating special ideas and specific messages to the polity. And what that does is it effectively authorizes or emboldens the kind of private violence we see taking place across the country toward Muslim institutions. So it's no coincidence that with the rise of this legislation and the kind of rhetoric we see coming from the White House, that there's a heightened incidence and uptake in hate crimes, hate incidents, arsons against mosques, attacks against visible Muslims. So that connection is really key.
When a state or a local legislature passes these anti-Sharia law, some people look at that and kind of laugh like, well, what was the chance of that happening anyway? But what you're talking about here is this sort of systematic painting that, okay, so there wasn't a chance that Sharia law was going to be implemented in this town, but it does draw this broad caricature of Islam.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to characterize it. So I don't think the primary objectives of legislators or the legislatures at large was to actually enact anti-Sharia law. I think it was very much used as a political strategy and a Trojan horse, if you will, right? To effectively popularize the idea that anything Islamic was threatening and violent. And then second, to kind of carry forward this trope or this fear that Muslims sort of have this, objective or mission to install Sharia law. So the states, I think there are a total of 11 or 12 states that actually enacted some version of the anti-Sharia law ban. I kind of think about those as windfalls, right? But the primary objective of these legislators wasn't to actually enact law or policy. It was to use the policy as an expedient to sort of curry fear and spread hysteria.
Who benefits from the spreading of fear and hysteria? Yeah.
Well, I mean, the primary beneficiaries are politicians, right? Largely conservative, and I would even say fringe conservative politicians who are using, anti-Muslim animus, Islamophobia as sort of a campaign strategy or a sort of a political strategy. We saw it paid considerable dividends for the president, President Trump, in the 2016 presidential election. And I think that, you know, his blueprint for success is being emulated on state and local levels by conservative politicians looking to employ that same strategy.
Is the book American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear, one way to push back against this?
I think so. I think the primary sort of objective of the book is to kind of demystify the fear. So I wrote the book in a very sort of general, accessible fashion. I want it to be read by, you know, lay people, individuals who might have negative sort of conceptions of Islam as a religion, might not know any Muslims. This is a book that you can pick up, and I think it's going to automatically dispel or quickly dispel a lot of stereotypes that are that might be held by even, you know, well-intentioned, benign individuals.
There's a long history that works into this. It also works into power and skin color and gender. And I know that you were a young person when you first found out about the Naturalization Act of 1790. Mm-hmm. I was older than you, and I had, I think, the same reaction that we weren't taught this in public school.
No, not at all. I mean, I was only taught it in law school. So the fact that, you know, I didn't learn about it as a political scientist or economics major in college, I was only able to encounter this law, and I'll, you know, briefly summarize what the law is. In 1790, there was legislation enacted almost automatically after the United States became a sovereign nation that mandated whiteness as a prerequisite for naturalized citizenship. So in short term, you had to be white in order to become a naturalized citizen.
And this is said in very plain English.
Yeah, very plain English. And this law lasted up until 1954. So for roughly 64 years of America's history, whiteness stood as a full-fledged mandate for naturalized citizenship.
Is part of this a sort of idea of Western exceptionalism that took root a couple, three centuries ago?
I think so. I think it was tied to Western exceptionalism, but it also kind of highlights how we think about race today in largely phenotypic or physical terms. However, I think that the 1790 law really manifested the idea that very early on in American history, that race was definitely conflated and overlapped very intimately with religion. So not only Christianity, but Protestantism was viewed to be foundational to whiteness. So in this country, a long time for this country, in this country's history, Catholics, for instance, were not classified as white. Jews weren't classified as white. So only Protestant Europeans were bona fide whites early on. So it was American exceptionalism, but it was also the idea that the United States was to be a Protestant white nation, which we know conflicts and smacks against the First Amendment Establishment Clause.
Many of the enslaved people who were brought over from Africa were not Christian, were Islamic or Muslim, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I write about this in the book, that a considerable percentage of the enslaved Africans in the antebellum South, 15 to 30%, social scientists hypothesize, were Muslims when they came. And it makes a lot of sense because a large number of the enslaved population came from West Africa. And this was a region where Islam was well entrenched by time slave traders came onto the continent.
You mentioned, I don't know what, I've read the statistic, I can't remember what it is, but a certain percentage of Americans don't know or don't know they know someone who is Muslim. Mm-hmm. How can that play into Islamophobia?
Yeah, I think the figure is roughly 40%, which when I read that a couple of years ago, I think it comes from a Pew Research study, if I'm not mistaken, that roughly 40% of Americans have never met a Muslim, which, you know, is staggering for me coming from, you know, Michigan, which, you know, you may know hosts one of the largest Muslim populations in the country. And I think that it's logical to understand why individuals who have encountered specific communities might hold on to, you know, negative stereotypes or misnomers about a community. And it isn't always malicious. It's not always an intentional desire to hate a group, especially when that converges with, you know, sort of a moment today where vilification or demonization of Muslims is ubiquitous. So we're effectively, I think that we're conditioned in the United States to have negative ideas of Muslims. So if that's sort of the landscape and you couple it with the idea that 40% of Americans haven't met a Muslim, then I think it's natural and it's logical that most individuals would have negative views of Muslims. I think for me, when I grapple with that, and part of my objective as a teacher and a scholar is to try to counter it in some ways. And obviously, you know, I as one individual can't go against what Fox News or what Donald Trump is saying about Islam and of Muslims. But I think a book like this can at least sort of, push the needle in the right direction to for audiences who are interested to learn a bit about what Muslim Americans look like, what their political experience is, that I think is going to surprise a lot of readers.
The name of the book is American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear. It's about American Islamophobia, but as any daily read of a major newspaper will tell you, Islamophobia is not a mere American phenomenon.
Yeah, definitely. I think that Islamophobia is definitely a global phenomenon. And I think the next book I'm writing is going to hone in on what's taking place with the rise of Islamophobia in other countries. And there's a lot of parallels. There's a lot of connections with what's happening in the States. But there are some really compelling distinctions that set apart, for instance, what's happening in India or what's happening in China or France from the American experience.
What's just one of those distinctions?
Yeah, I'll share one sort of case study, if you will.
Yeah.
So China, I think, illustrates, if I were to rank, the most sort of concerning and sadistic form of Islamophobia taking place in the world today. So in China, which we know is the most populous country in the world, there's a region in China on the northwest part of the country called Xinjiang, which is home to a sizable Uyghur Muslim population. And these Uyghur Muslims are indigenous to that part of the country and have, for decades, have been looking to establish an independent state. As a consequence of that political position and their desire to practice their religion, Islam, the state has assembled these mass internment camps, concentration camps, which look like the kind of concentration camps we saw in the United States during World War II with Japanese Americans, that have shades of what we saw in Europe during World War II, where the United Nations estimates as many as 1.5 million Muslims have been placed in these concentration camps.
Wow. What can someone hearing this conversation wants, you can read the book, but they want to do something to help eradicate fear, misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. What can the average person do?
Yeah, I think the average person, we tend to underestimate the kind of impact we have, especially in communities like Fayetteville, where the Muslim population, in Arkansas at large, where the Muslim population is sparse and not as large. I think that, individuals can do a great deal of impact with speaking to colleagues, speaking to classmates, speaking to family members, to dispel some of these foundational myths about Islam and of Muslims. And I think, whether it's reading the book or, turning to other resources or outlets to learn about the population, that kind of, I don't want to call it advocacy, but it is advocacy, can have a really progressive impact.
I'm just curious, you spent time in Florida, in Michigan. Mm-hmm. Did you have any question about moving to Arkansas? I mean, because Arkansas has not always a stellar reputation when it comes to understanding people that don't look like me.
Yeah. No, I took it as a challenge in many ways, right? So I think that for me, it enabled me to kind of enable my work to penetrate within a context in a space where it otherwise might not have had reach. So it's been exciting in that regard. And I think that I've had the good fortune of meeting individuals, whether it be at the university, whether it be at different town hall meetings that I speak at, whether it be meeting people on the street, to have really fruitful conversations. There's been some bumps in the road, but I think you learn, especially for me as a thinker and a scholar, you learn tremendously from the negative experiences as well. So, I kind of knew what I was in for, but I've definitely appreciated the experience.
One of the major influences for you was Edward Said.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about him.
Yeah. So Edward Said was a prominent public intellectual. He taught at Columbia University, wrote a book called Orientalism. And Orientalism is very much kind of this master discourse that sort of drives how I frame Islamophobia. The idea that the West, in demonizing the Muslim world, came to build its own sort of identity through kind of framing the Muslim world as its mirror opposite. So Saeed, in his work, not only his written work, which was brilliant, but also in his public advocacy, I think was just the most effective figure in dispelling many of these negative stereotypes and problematic narratives about Islam and of Muslims. Ironically enough, he himself wasn't Muslim. He grew up Christian and later on, I think, embraced an atheistic or agnostic worldview, which demonstrates that you don't have to be a believer in any faith to be sort of a truth teller on whatever issue you choose to champion.
That's the panacea, right? That's the goal.
Yeah.
Are you optimistic about the direction?
I'm optimistic in some regard. From other vantage points, I tend to take a more maybe more of a pessimistic outlook. I think we're living in very exciting yet frightening times. I think that this country is becoming polarized in many ways. So I think there are many camps that. Especially more, I don't want to use like conventional political spectral language, but I think there are greater communities and more populations now that are fighting for causes that go beyond who they are and their identities, which makes me optimistic. But I think that this current administration, again, has laid a template to use banners like xenophobia, anti-LGBTQ animus, Islamophobia, anti-Black racism, these forms of bigotry as really potent political tools to mobilize and galvanize voters. And I think that makes me a bit discouraged.
The cover of the book
is
amazing.
Thank you.
How did that come together? It's a young woman of color with the American flag, and she has this, you can project whatever emotion you think is on her face, but it's a stunning cover.
No, I appreciate that. I took a lot of time to kind of piece together a cover that I thought would be not necessarily attractive, but compelling slash provocative. And I was really mindful of doing a couple of things. Number one, I wanted to have a Black Muslim on the cover because it kind of goes against how we typically racialize Muslims as being Middle Eastern or Arab or brown, right? I think a Black sort of archetype does good work in introducing the fact that the first Muslims in the United States were in fact Black. And then second, that not all Muslims are brown or Middle Eastern. Second, the U.S. flag as a headscarf is a very sort of controversial image. There are voices largely on the right that say that you shouldn't, wear or use the American flag as clothing or an article of clothing. And second, there are voices on the left that say you shouldn't convert the headscarf into a symbol of patriotism. Now, I think there are, credible sort of opinions on both sides. And the reason I chose to have a Muslim woman wearing the U.S. flag as a headscarf is I wanted to use the cover as an sort of a spur or a catalyst to trigger that kind of conversation and sort of foreshadow the kind of discussions that were happening in the book.
That seems to be what you really want, conversation.
I think so. Exactly. Yeah. I'm not here looking or claiming to peddle the truth. I think I have an idea of what the truth might be, but I want to use the book as sort of a spur to trigger conversation that leads towards individuals' conceptions of what the truth might be.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Khaled Beydoun is an associate professor of law at the University of Arkansas and author of the book American Islamophobia, Understanding the Roots and Rise of Fear, now out in paperback. He visited the Carver Center for Public Radio earlier this week.